You are listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 10th of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is The Big Interview, our one-on-one programme in which people with extraordinary lives, powerful careers, and maybe even tall tales to tell sit down and tell us what really happened, how they got here, and what makes them tick. Today, I'm joined by John Ronson, the writer and broadcaster who's written on everything from psychopaths to secret societies, online shaming to personal and mass delusion. Ronson's stock in trade is the strange, the laughed at but rarely explored. His work is the careful research and the often hilariously funny and poignant stories behind the hearsay. Many listeners will know Ronson for his series of books and newspaper articles, as well as his TV documentaries and feature films. The Men Who Stare at Goats was turned into a Hollywood blockbuster by George Clooney. Frank Ronson's account of his former life as a member of Frank Sidebottom's papier-mâché-headed art pop group was also a recent hit starring Michael Fassbender. John Ronson was born in Wales in 1967 and now lives in New York City. John, welcome to the programme.
Hi, Robert. Nice to see you.
It's really nice to see you again. And doing some research, obviously, some back stuff, I've been a huge fan of your books, but one story stuck out for me as a kind of, as an emblematic John Ronson story, which is kind of a small one, actually, in the sort of some of the big names that we've put in your greatest hits there in the introduction, which is when you went on the set of Deal or No Deal, starring or hosted by a British former Radio 1 DJ and now sort of TV personality, Noel Edmonds. And that seemed to tell me a lot about how you write and how you research and all the rest of it. Is that sort of fair to say? Is it sort of a very everyday story of sort of mass delusion?
Well, actually, funnily enough, that one came about because I was depressed. I was trying to write a book about the credit industry. I was trying to write a kind of Men Who Stare at Goats of credit cards.
Right.
And I should say, this was like 2006 or something before the crash. And my American publisher keeps telling me, like, if I hadn't abandoned the book, then that I would have been such a soothsayer. That book would have come out just as the crash had happened.
So the memoir Noel Edmonds ruined my professional career.
No. What happened was I spent like 3 or 4 months working on this book about the credit industry. And I would meet all these people whose job it was to find clever, manipulative ways to enslave us in their credit spider's web. And it was a great topic. And you could tell it was a house of cards and it was all going to fall.
Yeah.
But everybody I met was incredibly boring. And it made me realise, actually, and I write this in the psychopath test, if you want to get away with wielding true malevolent power, be boring. Because journalists like writing about eccentric people because it makes us look good, because they light up the page. And I abandoned my credit book because I just couldn't make these people light up the page. And I was so miserable, I thought I would wake up, one of the only times in my life this has happened, I would wake up and I'd sort of shuffle downstairs and eat some cereal and I'd think it's only about 10 hours before I can sit down and watch TV. the day, because I couldn't make this book work. So I thought, I have to do something fun or else, you know, I'm just so miserable. So I went on the set of Deal or No Deal for about a week and Noel Edmonds lifted me out of my funk because it was so much fun being on that set.
And it's a strange one. I mean, I wonder how, I mean, that seemed like an obvious thing. I think you start that story by saying you were on the treadmill at your gym and suddenly this thing popped onto the TV and you'd watched it a few times, but you never realised quite how sort of strange it was and how almost a non-format it is for a game show. And then you go, you phone up Endemol, the production company, you go to the studios and you meet all the contestants who are sort of in a hothouse environment, aren't they, in a hotel.
Yes.
And it is, it seems like a sort of, as I say, it seems like a typical story for you. So I guess lots of your readers and the people that have seen the things that have turned into feature films as well would love to know where the sort of kernel of those ideas come from and when you kind of know, you click your fingers and you know that this is kind of a goer.
Well, I think you always want to think to yourself, okay, whatever happens is going to be interesting. Because I'm not the kind of writer who wants to solve the mystery before they have the adventure.
Yeah.
Somebody like Ben Goldacre, who I admire very much, but he writes in a completely different way to me. He's an expert and he knows right at the beginning what he wants to
do. Is that one of those mysteries where you see the murder and then you see Sherlock solve it? Sort of
You know, a Ben Goldacre book. Most non-fiction books will be, this is a book about this, and I'm going to tell you this, 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 and this, and then over the next 80,000 words, they do exactly what they say they're going to do at the beginning of the book. And for me, that's what's the point of that? I've always felt that nonfiction should be as mysterious and as knotty and as twisty-turny as a novel. And I'm surprised not more writers, nonfiction writers, feel that way. So I don't know. I set off on an adventure where I don't know what's going to happen, which then, of course, creates a problem, which is that maybe nothing will happen. Maybe it'll be crap. And I've spent money and I've disappointing people. And so one of the ingredients, I think, is, OK, I don't know what's going to happen, but it's probably going to be good. It's probably going to be interesting. So there's some kind of mystery that hopefully I'll be able to solve in some kind of entertaining way. So that's one thing. Another thing is you don't want it to be people that you don't like, that you hate. Somebody's just asked me to do a big game hunting convention, and I think I'm going to turn it down because I'm going to hate those people. So there has to be some.
So it sounds shared... for this, before we, while we'll carry on with this thought, but just on, mm-hmm. on that, on being invited to a big game convention, mm-hmm. people obviously search you out and go, right, this would be perfect. Who's the perfect person to write about this, to make this weird thing even weirder, or make this weird thing actually mysterious? It's John Ronson. Do you have to sort of turn down a lot of things where people want to have it John Ronsoned, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, because they don't always understand, I think, what that means.
That actually for you it should be a mystery as well.
Yeah, a mystery. I think there has to be some shared empathy. Like, I have to empathise with the people I'm writing about, be able to find some humanity in them. What I don't want to do is go somewhere where I know I'm not going to like them and not like them. And as a result, I become representative.
It's been 1D.
Yeah, and also, when that happens, I then become representative of acceptable society.
And God forbid.
Yeah, and then everybody's preconceptions remain intact and everybody identifies with me because I am the good liberal person. I'm the social justice person. Everybody can feel comfortable that we all, you know, there's a line in my public shaming book where I say that on social media we are defining the boundaries of normality by tearing apart the people outside. And that's something that I don't want to do. So what I love is going on stories where we're the crazy people, we're the interestingly irrational, dark, spiralling, weird people.
Yeah, yeah.
Not those people over there, but us. And so my Deal or No Deal story fits into that, I think, for a couple of reasons.
Because you're a viewer of that show.
I was a viewer of that show. The people who honestly believe that their numerical systems are going to win them £250,000 they're us. You know. So the people acting like weird adherents of some weird cult are us. Nice, normal people like us.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was people that you profile. Some of the people that really stand out from your books, because you, as you say, you're looking for great characters, which is maybe why your financial sort of the misdemeanors of the credit industry book didn't quite fire off as you hoped it to. Do all these people come back to you? I have a feeling that lots of people come back to you and love the way that you've portrayed them rather than the other way around.
Yeah, mostly. Not always.
And I mean, some of these people are quite strange people. I mean, one person, we were talking about this before I came down to do this interview, is David Shaler, former MI5 spy here in the UK, who then decided he was a messiah, who then turned into a woman as well. These people, do they still email you? Do they still want a bit of update? Do they still want some Ronson magic sparkled on their lives?
Yeah, literally in David Shaler's case, we follow each other on Facebook and Twitter and we chat from time to time.
Yeah.
Once in a while, people get annoyed. And whenever that happens, it makes me feel unhappy. But at the same time, you have to remind yourself that your responsibility is more to the story and the readers than it is to the person being written about. But you kind of know that, in a way, it's kind of scant comfort, because really what I want to do is make absolutely everybody happy, including people who I disagree with. You want them to feel happy too. So there's often people in my stories who I vehemently disagree with, but I don't want them to feel mugged by me. I don't want them to feel unhappy.
It's a tough journalistic job to do that, isn't it? To not burn any of those bridges. A lot of people would do the story, and none of this work is muckraking, but do something that other people might think of as that, and then turn their back and delete the emails and never need to speak to that person again. I feel that for you, that's absolutely not something that you want to do.
Yeah, because it's You know, it's what I said before about not wanting to be a representative of normality. Yeah. You know, not wanting to be a representative of acceptable conformist society. Because it's just too easy. It's too easy.
I wanted to ask you about, we talked about sort of some of the great characters in your books and in the films. My favourite character in most of them is yourself. And it's a, there's, you have such a distinct way of writing that's super difficult to copy. I think maybe other people have tried it. But has it always been the case that you kind of put a little bit of yourself in, and a lot of it is you're Frodo going to find the ring. And as you say, no one knows what's going to happen. Is it a fine balance to know how much of yourself to put in your stories?
You know what? I really think I get the balance right. But that, I've been doing that and thinking about that for 30 years now. So I feel... There were times like 20 years ago when I was sick of putting myself into stories, and I'd try and write stories where I wasn't in there at all, and the note would always come back from whatever editor it was.
Where are you?
Yeah, put yourself in there a bit more. Yeah. So now I'm kind of at peace with it. I know when to do just enough and not too much.
And it's one of those things going back as well. This is, you played by Donald Gleeson in Frank, and maybe that's a little bridge for us to go back to your early days and before journalism, when you're in Frank Sidebottom's band, as we said at the beginning. It'd be great if you could paint a little picture of your life in Wales and then beyond as part of a band on the road in the back of a van, and how that kind of morphed into your career as a writer.
Sure. Well, I grew up in just Cardiff suburbia, like a nice Cardiff suburb called Lisvain, but it was still suburbs of Cardiff. I always thought of myself as middle class. And then I remember one time my producer for my first TV show came to my house in Cardiff for some reason. I think we were filming in Cardiff, and I showed him where I lived, and he kind of said, you see yourself, you thought you were middle class. I went, yeah. He said, you were lower middle class. So there you go, I was lower middle class.
What a bastard.
I know. And my dad was in wholesale and my mum was a social worker. I certainly wasn't happy. I was an unhappy child. I was bullied. I was badly bullied at school. But before that, that kind of started when I was about 14. But before that, I had quite permissive parents, and they would like drop me off at gigs. Like when I was probably 12, I went on my own to see the Specials.
Yeah, this is, I mean, this is the kind of bedrock of the beginning of that film, which is why I love that so much. And the book that, you know, you may be shy, but very outward bound in your taste.
Totally. And in fact, not only did I go and see the Specials by myself when I was 11 or 12, but I pretended to faint so I would be lifted over the barrier and I could stand on the side of the stage and watch the show. So I did. So I pretended to faint and I stood by the side of the show and I had a camera, and Terry Hall came up to me and said, are you OK? And I said, are you in the Specials? And he said, I'm the singer. And then I stood there for the whole show and I felt like Alice through the Looking Glass. That was probably my biggest life moment. Then I got to be about 14 and I got fat and I was bullied at Cardiff High School, which again sort of, I guess, pushed me.
You were on the outside looking at power structures and sort of cabals of people, even at that age, maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
Not wanting to make this too heavy. But, you know.
But no, I think it's true. I don't know whether it was self-fulfilling or not. It probably was a bit self-fulfilling that's sort of where I naturally was. It wasn't like I was somebody who wanted to be part of Cardiff High School society, yet was ostracised. I think I was always destined to be on the outside of Cardiff High School society. But the way I ended up there was to get fat and be pushed out there. So then I was like desperate to leave. So I left, I moved to London, went to the Polytechnic of Central London, which is now the University of Westminster. And after about 2 years, you know, the day I left Cardiff and moved to London, everything changed. I mean, my mother dropped me off at the Hall of Residence on Bolsover Street. And that minute, my life went from being terrible to fantastic. Straight away, kids were like, oh, do you want to come out with us tonight? And I started getting girlfriends. Like, I lost all the weight almost immediately. And I started getting girlfriends. And just overnight, my life turned great.
I want to talk about America as well, because it looms large in so much of your work. You now live in New York, as we said in the introduction. How does that work in terms of your work and your tone of voice and the way that you deal with people? Because I feel that certainly your earlier writing, you'd kind of go to America and feel slightly, there was a bit of the shy Brit going to America and everything's big and everything's weird, and that fed into that. Does that get slightly less easy now to find stories, or now that people know who you are there?
No, actually, now that I'm pretty well known, for every story I lose because I'm pretty well known, I get a bunch of access that I probably wouldn't have got if I wasn't well known. So I think it balances itself out.
Okay. That's an interesting thing, actually, about the interaction, the sort of off-the-page interaction you have with your interviewees. Mm-hmm. How much of that do you feel that needs to go in? I suppose that's just an editorial... That's an innate editorial sense that you have of how much goes in and how much doesn't. But it is interesting. I suppose you are always kind of, in some way, cutting deals with the people that turn up in your books, aren't you?
Totally. In the end, honestly, I think whether I put stuff like that in the book or not, quite often it's arbitrary, and quite often it's got something vaguely to do with pacing. Like, okay, I know that this is going to lead somewhere amazing. How much of the preamble do I want? So it's much more kind of pacing question, really, than anything else. Although sometimes it's kind of nice. I mean, if I'm acting, if I do something stupid to get access to something, then I'll quite often put that
in. We want to read that.
Yes. Yeah. So, for instance, with in the psychopath test, I go and see this CEO called Chainsaw Al Dunlap, and I'm asking him questions, and at this point in the story, I'm drunk with my psychopath spotting skills, way more than I deserve to be, because I'm not a trained professional, not a trained professional psychopath spotter. So I'm asking Al Dunlap all these questions, then I'm writing my notebook. I do have a notebook on that day, and I'm writing all these little, you know, clues that whether or not he's a psychopath without him like looking at. And so obviously I'm going to put all of that stuff in the book because it shows, you know, it's an insight into my own ridiculousness.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. People kind of want to read that because there is always the danger, a bit like a protagonist in a J.G. Ballard novel that kind of discovers some awful secret and becomes beguiled by it and ends up kind of being the ringleader of this awful, you know, group of people or whatever, this society or whatever. There is always the fear in a John Ronson book that you might get sucked in yourself. Does that happen? Are you always kind of slightly sometimes on the brink of wondering if you yourself are a psychopath, exhibiting the outward signs of craziness? Or is that a nice sort of editorial conceit again, I wonder?
Oh, no. I love getting sucked in and changing my mind totally about something. But it never works if you're faking it, if it's a conceit. I think people can read that a mile off. So with the psychopath test, I never thought I might be a psychopath, although I do note every time I behave psychopathically to get a story in the book. But I never thought I might be a psychopath because I suffer from such terrible anxiety. So I could never be. There's no question that I'm a psychopath. But I became totally drunk with my psychopath spotting powers to the extent that I remember my friend Peter Strawn, who I co-wrote Frank with, and he wrote the Men Stay at Goat screenplay, said to me at one point, we were on a plane to Toronto when they were premiering The Men Stay at Goats. And I said, I can spot psychopaths everywhere. And, you know, I sort of told him. Yeah. And he said, John, I'm worried about you. You've really changed. And so that's how far I went. But then that's great, you know, because that's because if you're a fictional protagonist of a novel, those are the kind of changes that you want to go through for it to be a satisfying read. So the fact that I went through those kind of changes in real life means that the book is so much richer for it. I always think a non-fiction book should have all the ambition of a novel, and that includes the protagonist going through huge changes.
Well, I would like to go back to the public shaming book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. It's actually my favourite of your books, maybe because it still feels, I mean, all of them do, but it feels so current. Every day there's something, every day. Anyone with a Twitter feed can sort of associate themselves, I suppose, with some of your characters and their pain and some of your own that's happened sort of since then. And it starts actually with someone, sort of a spam bot, kind of trolling, not trolling you, but pretending to be you online.
Yeah.
That makes a nice start for the book itself. But is that really how the thought process went for that book, that it started off with a sort of someone just nicking your identity and in quite a sort of savoury way? They were just a big foodie, apparently. But, yeah. But it kind of got out of hand.
Well, I think yes and no is the answer to that question. So I was looking around for another book after the psychopath test, and it started off actually being a book about memory. And the real starting point of the book was basically this masseur. My wife had booked me as a special treat, a spa weekend, in the countryside, which is like the worst.
Why am I laughing? I don't know why. It's funny.
It's the worst.
We're smirking.
I know, because the thing is, it baffles me that she would do that as a special treat, because she knows I don't like being touched. No, I'm kidding. I don't mind. I'm fine with being touched. But the masseur on the table, I said, I've got a terrible memory. I can't remember anything about my childhood. It's all gone. And the masseur said, most people who don't remember anything about their childhoods, when they recover their lost memories, it turns out that they were sexually abused by their parents. So I said, well, I'd remember that. And that stayed with me.
What a wonderful bedside manner he had.
She. So that stayed with me. And I thought memory's an interesting subject. And that took me into courtrooms, false memories of witnesses and so on, and the judicial system. And then I had dinner with Clive Stafford Smith a few times, who I'm really fond of. And he was like desperate for me to do a kind of Making a Murderer type thing about the justice system. And you know, I never really found the right story. But then I started thinking about kind of justice, other types of justice. And I started to notice citizen justice on the internet and how that was beginning to make all the same mistakes of the actual justice system, damning people on the scantest evidence and so on. And then I remembered that a couple of years earlier, I had publicly shamed these academics for creating this fake John Ronson Twitter account. And so I decided to make that the starting point, because it kind of was the starting point, but I got there in a slightly circuitous way, if you understand what I mean.
And this book has, it's not a campaigning book. I think I'm right in saying.
You know what? I think it kind of is. I think this is the
I wonder whether it's because of the nature of what it's about, it's become a sort of campaign book. But your tone is not that of a campaigner.
Yes. You see, that's interesting because, when I wrote the book, I didn't see it as a campaigning book at all. I saw it as just another one of my adventure stories. But the response to the book was so loud and very often loudly positive, but very often loudly negative too. And so I became, in a way that's never happened to me in any of my other stories, I became so much a part of the story. People were trying to publicly shame the book and me, and people were creating these kind of false narratives about me. You know, people were lying about me for their own agendas. And so as a result, it became so personal. And then I started meeting up with people who themselves were involved in like anti-shaming campaigns, like, so I'd have breakfast with Monica Lewinsky and things like that. And I suddenly thought, you know what, this has somehow become, even if I didn't intend it to be a campaigning book, this has somehow become part of a campaign now.
And let's talk about these crazy successes, the men that stare at goats. Do you have any insight into how things get made? Some things get made into series and some things get made into feature films. Do you have any insight into how that process happens? Because obviously it's wonderful, it's great, fame and fortune ensue, but it's often an arbitrary process, right?
It's a very arbitrary process. You know, my book Them got optioned the same time that The Men Stare at Goats did, and Mike White and Edgar Wright was attached. Edgar was attached to direct, Mike White wrote a screenplay, Reese Witherspoon and Jack Black were attached to star in it. I was going to be played by Reese Witherspoon. And Mike White wrote the first draft screenplay, which was wonderful. I mean, he wrote School of Rock. And The Good Girl. He's a very talented man. And then apparently, so after a couple of years of, you know, all of this reaching this moment, Mike White and Edgar went into Universal and they said, we've read the screenplay, we don't really like it so much. And they went, oh, okay. And then it all went, and then it died. That's it. It was dead.
They didn't even have lunch.
No, didn't even have lunch.
Okay.
With the movies that I've been involved with that have got made, honestly, the reason why they got made was because a big star got attached. So when George Clooney said he wanted to do The Men Stare at Goats, which I don't take credit for, you know, they love Peter Strawn and
your co-writer.
Yeah. And he wrote the screenplay. I wasn't involved in the Goat screenplay at all. So the second George Clooney says, OK, I'm going to do this, then everything falls into place instantly. And the same with Frank, actually. The minute Michael Fassbender said he wanted to do it, which I do take credit for that one, then it all fell into place kind of immediately.
So this is all kind of high dudgeon and is really exciting stuff. And it must be fantastically interesting as well for a journalist like yourself to be in this world as well. You know, no small amount of presumably comedy and tragedy and pathos in these meetings, which I don't expect you to tell us about.
Well, you know what? I mean, I've had some unhappy experiences with the film industry. I've met some very nice people, like Bong Joon-ho, who I think is wonderful. Lately, I've been having a few Skypes with Tilda Swinton about Okja, and she seems like amazing. I've also met some extremely unpleasant... George Clooney was very lovely as well. And Peter Strawn is one of the people I like more than anyone. But I've also met some extremely unpleasant people in the movies too. Never the actors. The actors are always nice. Michael Fassbender was very nice. So it's not all been pleasant. But by and large, it's not that dissimilar. I mean, 90% of my movie work is sitting at home working on the screenplay. More than 90%, like 95%. It's a piece of writing. It's making a piece of writing work, just like writing a book or a newspaper article. You know, I put as much love and care and passion into a 3,000-word piece for The Guardian that I will for Okja or Frank or a book. You know, it's all just writing to me.
And just finally, I wondered if you have a favourite story from one of your collections, whether it's a small footnote, whether you have a favourite character, or whether you can, you know, whether things stand out as a gold standard for yourself, which is something that you want to achieve with the next thing, or you want to do a story like that again in the next couple of years, whether you have a favourite.
You know, I think, what popped into my head when you asked that was, so in the psychopath test, I meet the Scientologists, and they tell me that psychiatry is nuts. And to prove it, they take me to Broadmoor to meet a man who they say faked madness. And
this is Tony.
Tony in Broadmoor. So I go to Broadmoor and I meet Tony, and he says, "Yeah, I faked madness." And he tells me the story. In the book, this is more interesting.
Is this about the bees?
No. It's about a transition. Okay. I'm about to tell you, this is a story about a transition. So then I leave Tony and I talk to a psychiatrist. He says, "Yes, we accept that Tony faked madness. But what we've determined is that he's a psychopath and that only a psychopath would fake madness." So faking your brain going wrong is evidence that your brain has gone wrong. And then he said, "And if you want to know more about psychopaths, why don't you go on a course?" And so I go on a course. And that translates, you know, this is where everything gets golden, is when one really great narrative can just naturally take you to the next stop on the train, to another really great narrative. And that's what I'm always looking for. What I love the most is when, and actually I've just started working on this podcast series, and something similar has happened in this podcast series. Like, I'm doing this story and I'm interviewing this girl and she says something, and that will then, the story will just pivot to a very natural great second narrative, which I couldn't ever juxtapose the two things together if she hadn't said this one thing. And those are the things I'm always looking for.
John Ronson, the thinking man's Reese Witherspoon. Thank you very much for talking us through the big interview.
Thanks, Rob. It was really nice to be here.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Robert Bounds, in conversation with John Ronson. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Luty, researched by Gaia Lutz, and edited by Nina Norek. And don't forget to subscribe to this and any of our other programmes on Monocle 24. They can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, or, of course, monocle.com. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye, and thanks for tuning in.